We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall never surrender until, in God's good time, the new world, with all its power and might, steps forth to the rescue and the liberation of the old.
The time has come to say fair's fair, to pay the rent, to pay our share. The time has come, a fact's a fact, it belongs to them. Let's give it back.
From the far edge of the earth, broadcast by cable and satellite, this is Radio Equal Shock with Alex Smith. Gaia, the great interconnected force of living things on a minor planet called Earth. British scientist James Lovelock wondered how life created its own space with the oxygen and nutrients we all need. It's a soothing idea. Some Greens took it further, suggesting Gaia is a superconsciousness that watches over the balance and survival of us all. A few worship Gaia. Dr. Peter Ward, a deep-time digger and climate investigator, says Gaia, if there is one, can also be a mass murderer. The rock record shows at least five great mass extinctions before us. Ward offers us a different Greek myth, Medea, the wife of Jason the Argonaut, who swiped the golden fleece. In a fit of rage against her husband, Medea killed her own children. In a new book, The Medea Hypothesis, Peter Ward says Gaia is out. Bountiful nature can become ecocidal, and only intelligent life, I guess that's us, can stop the death cycle we are now approaching. Peter always stuffs us full of the latest science. He's not well known to the public, but other climate scientists are listening closely as this brilliant mind sparks off a new paradigm for life and death on planet Earth. But can we trust a creature with obvious pathological flaws to save the species? Should humans try to replace nature?
Within the ship, of course, there was ticking and a small red hand moved towards zero. In a little while, the ship would blow, and with it would go the island and a great chunk of the sea. But the beings could not know. Second by second, with the utter mechanical loyalty of the machine, the small red hand crept forward.
Following our interview with Peter Ward, I answer a few questions about this program, Radio EcoShock, as a local college station turns the tables to interview the elusive Alex Smith. We talk the future of food, the economy, and radio itself. You'll also hear the new climate anthem, A Reworked Beds Are Burning, from a host of celebrities. And now to our feature interview. This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Peter Ward, paleontologist and professor of biology, as well as earth and space sciences at the University of Washington in Seattle. Peter last joined us on our December 9th, 2008 program for a discussion of his book, Under a Green Sky. Now he's back with a new idea, sure to rattle a lot of people. It's called the Medea Hypothesis. Peter Ward, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
And thanks so much for having me again.
Well, your new book picks a fight with a beloved scientist, Sir James Lovelock. Can you explain Lovelock's Gaia hypothesis, and then we'll get to your answer to it?
Yeah, the Gaia hypothesis is really a wonderfully introspective, I would say, from both a mental and a psychological point of view, hypothesis about how the world works and how nature works. And introspective in the sense that it has by itself entirely spawned what we call New Age or New World religions. It really has a sense that the Earth is alive, and or the Earth and its systems act in such a way to better or optimize the planet for life itself.
And I gather that it's now split up into two versions that you take on in your book.
Yeah, there's always been an extreme fringe, and Lovelock himself is really one of the amazing intellects of the 20th century, although for a variety of reasons, I think some of his 21st century ideas are getting increasingly batty, and I'll go into these in a minute. But it also split off into the whole New Age business, which he never advocated. And the most extreme view of Gaia is that the Earth itself, including all the hard stuff that most of the Earth is made up of, is part of a living being, that we are one gigantic living planet with this thin veneer of gas and life itself over this much thicker, rocky planet, but the whole thing's alive. And that not even Lovelock himself really advocates that, although in the past he's dabbled in that. The other is that there are many systems equivalent to, say, our organ systems or our blood system, which maintain life, and that through time the whole makes it better for the individual.
And I guess that even that branch has split into that which optimizes the planet for life and that which merely regulates the planet somehow using biological means so that life can continue.
Yeah, that's really, you've hit it beautifully, actually. That really is the division that goes on. How much is optimization? How much is just letting life continue? I don't think anyone argues with the fact that life influences the planet. It influences geology. It influences the gas of the atmosphere. It has all of these effects on the physical world, and that obviously vice versa. The physical world has effects on biology. That's almost the weakest kind of Gaia hypothesis, is that there is this interaction. No one disputes that. On the other hand, the sense that life itself is making the world better for future life is the other aspect, and that's really where James Lovelock is. It's kind of like you buy a house or rent a hotel room, if you will, and then while you're there in that hotel, you paint it and clean it up and put in new furniture and spend all this money on it so that the next guest has even a better hotel room. I mean, that's not really what a lot of us think that life is doing here.
So by contrast to that, what is the Medea hypothesis?
Well, Medea is the worst Greek mother, because Gaia is the name that Lovelock came up with for the good mother, and it was the Greek idea of good mother Earth. And I just almost tongue-in-cheek, but not too much, came up with this idea of Medea. And from Greek literature, we know of Jason and the Golden Fleece. He ran off with King Aetes, who had stolen the fleece, his daughter Medea, married Medea, and Jason, it turns out, was a pretty good captain and a really bad husband. And Medea, in a fit of pique, murdered their children several years later when Jason found himself flirting with other queens. So if you want a bad mother, Medea is probably about the worst, and the sense is not so tongue-in-cheek. Because of the mass extinctions and other episodes in Earth history, Mother Earth has murdered her children over and over and over again.
And I remember in your book, Under a Green Sky, you came to this chunk of rock that looked like about, if I remember correctly, about 10 million years, where there was practically not much alive left in the fossil record, at least. That must be very startling to look at.
Oh, absolutely. And those were the seeds that brought Medea, at least in my own mind, to life, is when you look at these long intervals of time after mass extinction, it sure doesn't look like life has been optimizing the planet for much of anything. We really go back to a microbial world, and we have a sense that it's not getting better, it's just getting worse. And when life does come back, it's different life. I mean, you can't say better, you can't say worse, but you can certainly say different.
One of the great things about this book, in my opinion, is your ability to summarize and teach us the latest cutting-edge earth science. There have been some really remarkable discoveries just in the last couple of years. I'd like to get into some of that brain food. But could you start by explaining what you see as a possible flaw in evolution that could end up wrecking our living planet?
Well, it's funny you say that. It was one of the first lectures I gave about this. I gave a trial tune-up to my department, which is composed of a lot of really good biologists, and one of the best, a man named Joe Felsenstein, who's a National Academy member evolutionist, sort of raised his hand up and said, well, you know, after you've given this presentation and knowing what I know about life, you're giving way too much chops to this Medea. I think evolution is really kind of a dumb tinkerer and kind of blunders from place to place. And he suggested that I call it not the Medea hypothesis, but the Mr. Bean hypothesis, that evolution is just this dumb blunderer. And that actually might be a much better sense of what happens, is that there are these evolutionary breakthroughs, and sometimes they're better for the species, more often they're worse, but quite often they have an effect on the entire ecosystem. A new species doesn't care what it does to anything else. It just wants to reproduce, make more of itself. We talk about the selfish gene. Well, I think we really need to talk about the selfish species.
I guess we're a prime example, but also some of the bacteria would take over if they could.
Absolutely, and they've been here before. They will be here again. There is a certain definite finite limit to the age of animals, just that is dictated by the nature of our enlarging sun, by the nature of an aging Earth. Everything's finite. Well, so too is the age of animals, and the bacteria are laying in wait to take back the planet that advanced animal life took from them 500 billion years ago.
Well, I'd also like to imagine a mass extinction caused by a greenhouse effect. I don't think the public has any idea of what that might be like. Can you give us some clues of what happened?
Yeah, when I wrote Under a Green Sky, I tried to put out some op-ed pieces or something about this, and I was sort of viewed as a fringe lunatic, and that, although that may definitely still be the case, finally, actually, some people are waking up because of a whole raft of independent studies, both from the past mass extinctions, but what is happening on our planet today. I mean, I suggest that a greenhouse extinction just occurs when the planet warms up enough that the poles and the tropics are so similar in temperature that it slows down ocean currents. Slowing ocean currents causes the ocean to lose its oxygen. An oxygen-free ocean spawns a group of bacteria that animals don't like. In fact, these bacteria can kill off animals. Well, we're starting to see that right now. We have a warming poles, and the poles are warming radically faster than the tropics. Tropics just can't warm much warmer. The poles can warm up all the way to the temperature of the tropics. And so you have this asymmetry. The asymmetry is causing the heat difference between the polar regions and the equator to drop, and as that drops, there's less impetus for wind and current. As things stagnate, oxygen stops being pumped into the ocean. And there you go. So NASA got hold of this. A bunch of us were taken down to NASA Ames at the behest of the director there, saying, look, is this a bunch of nonsense or is it possible? And 15 scientists were invited, and every one of them stood up and said, you know, this is looking pretty bad. In fact, it's looking like it could happen way faster than anybody's suggesting, including a slowdown to the point of near cessation of the Pacific gyres starting next century. So it's definitely happening.
Well, I thought about you and your theory when I was listening to a lecture, one of the lectures at the Oxford Beyond 4 Degrees climate conference that was just held at the end of September, and Professor John Schellenhuber was talking about oxygen-free zones that were developing in the Indian Oceans at key levels where fish would live, and I thought, whoa, I wonder if that's the beginning of this.
It absolutely is. I mean, that conference scared everybody because simply the fact that there would be 4 degrees, and that's 4 degrees centigrade, by 2060, it has to be such a wake-up call, and yet the United States right now is so tied up in blocking health care, there's no conversation about a far more important bill in my mind, which is the climate bill, the climate change bills. Those things are just stalled. And we really are facing some very bad times, not for us. I mean, everybody who hears this program, we're fine. Our children and their children and their children are not going to be fine.
Well, all this leads to one of the central messages of your book, which I think will confuse some people. For me, I was reading it in the long past and in the long future. The real threat is not increasing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, but dropping levels of CO2. Could you explain that for us?
I know. Nature is just full of irony. I think it's the most delicious, but most frustrating of all aspects of the universe, I think. Yeah, the irony is that over the long period of time, what's going to doom animal life isn't too much CO2, but not enough. It turns out that animals, and this is one of the things I point out in the book, is that life is taking so much carbon dioxide and putting it in places where it can no longer be recycled. that a half billion years from now, there cannot be more animals on this planet, because we're going to lose all plant life. And once we lose plant life, we'll lose animal life soon after. And it's simply because every time you look at a mountain that's white, made of limestone, you're looking at a whole lot of carbon that life has taken out of the atmosphere by producing skeletons and then simply deposited in places where it cannot be recycled. We are doing just the opposite right now. We're taking carbon out of rock and putting it back in the atmosphere. And that's something in the long term we humans will have to do. I think we have it as a species to be able to regulate the carbon in our atmosphere to maintain animal life on this particular planet for billions of years. But right now, the short-term threat is too much carbon in the atmosphere. And then the long-term threat is not enough. And what we are doing right now is squandering our bank account of carbon that we're really going to need in the hundreds of millions of years to come.
We're talking with Peter Ward about his book, The Medea Hypothesis. Peter, in this work, you also gave me my first image of the natural future of this planet and the time limit that all life lives under. You just referred to it. How long have we got, Doc?
Half billion years. I was at a science fiction convention where one of the science fiction writers looked at me and said, "You've got to be kidding." And I said, "Why?" She said, "Well, why would anybody care about a half billion years from now?" And my thought was, well, look, you know, there's no reason that species have to go extinct. We don't have a gene in us that says you're going to go extinct in 2 million years. That doesn't happen. We have that aging gene that kills us, but species don't. We have bacteria on this planet that have not changed, as far as we can tell, in 3.5 billion years. And there's no reason that we as humans couldn't stay and engineer this planet until the ultimate end of Earth is going to be in 7 or 8 billion years, when the sun goes red giant. But we've got billions of years if we keep our wits about us, literally.
Well, I could buy that in the long run, but I have to tell you, I'm a little worried about the call for geoengineering in the short run. Some of the right-wing think tanks and even the oil companies are getting on board with geoengineering as a way to bypass carbon controls and the Copenhagen Treaty. So and should we really turn the Earth over to the people who can't run an economy or even a train system? It worries me a bit.
Well, that worries me a lot, but let's expand the sense of geoengineering and say that planting a tree is one of the most profound and efficient methods of geoengineering. What we're talking about is changing the natural order out of what, say, Mother Nature would have produced at this moment and amplifying. I think, again, we need to regulate and we need to control our atmosphere. We need to. If I had one button that I could make that everybody on Earth ought to have, it would be save the ice sheets. I mean, nothing else. Save the ice sheets. Because as go the ice sheets, goes human civilization. If we melt any further of our Antarctic and our Greenland ice sheets, and not ice caps, anything floating on the ocean is sea level neutral, but melting the continental ice sheets causes sea level to rise or fall or rise or fall. And look, the near-term problem is we're about to head to 9 billion people. If we raise sea level even 2 meters, we've reduced an enormous amount of agriculture. So you have the intersection of 9 billion people with, say, 1/4 reduction in food somewhere in the next 50 to 100 years. And that's disaster. That is total disaster. And that's really the greatest single challenge facing us, is the short-term sea level rise, agriculture, and too many mouths to feed.
And the biological level, another strange idea for me in your book is that we may not be living in the great age of plant and animal life, but rather in a declining old age of life on this planet. How did I get the idea from so many scientists that we were right now at the peak, the great green golden age of life?
It's funny how all these preconceived notions just go by the wayside. When I was raised in my first classes, I always read, even as a boy, that the way evolution worked is first there were fish, and then fish gave rise to amphibians, and we had the great age of amphibians, and then we had the age of reptiles, and then an age of mammals. And yet the fossil record tells us that the age of mammals, the first great age of mammals, preceded the dinosaurs. The mammal-like reptiles, the first true mammals of the late Permian age, were wiped out by a greenhouse extinction. Dinosaurs were just a big mistake. There should have never been this age of dinosaurs but for this very nasty, volcanically produced, very anti-Gaian, very pro-Medean greenhouse extinction that ended the Permian.
Now, how do you judge things to be, just getting back to the hypothesis, how do you judge things to be Medean versus Gaian, just so our listeners can tune into that idea?
Well, again, the whole Medean scheme of things is that life blunders around, and that there's really no, say, planning, there's no sense of optimizing, there's no plan, if you will. Optimization indicates there's a plan somewhere, that somehow things are naturally or unnaturally running according to some plan. Well, there's no planning. I mean, evolution is just this dumb tinkerer sort of bouncing around. Things that work well do well for a while until natural changes of the planet and the system makes other things do well. But this sense that there's optimization taking place, I think, is ridiculous. And what it does, it's like a false crutch. And this is where I just am getting on the case of Dr. Lovelock, is that he has this sense now that Gaia will take care of all the human problems. And he used to say that it would be by wiping out the humans, and he keeps going back to that. I personally think we're pretty much extinction-proof. I think the technology is going to make us essentially immune to most of the things that kill most species. Now, it doesn't say extinction-proof means happy. It doesn't mean that we're going to have rich lives. It just might mean that our species goes on for a very long time. But Dr. Lovelock in Seattle was on radio saying the most unbelievable things, saying that right now China is buying up Africa because in the next 20 to 30 years, China will transfer all its population to Africa. Now, he said this publicly on the radio and then in front of a crowd. Now, he's right in saying that climate change is a big problem, but when you say that China is about to colonize Africa with a straight face, I mean, you lose a whole lot of credibility. So anyway, it just seems I'm raging against this particular machine because he's a beloved man, it's a beloved theory, and I think it really gives us a crutch that shouldn't be used.
Well, it was helping the environmental movement to be able to get people through to the idea that there's more than strip malls in your job and that, in fact, we may be connected to all of the species, that we have some sense of ourselves as life on this planet, and I don't think that would be harmful. What's your take?
No, I absolutely agree with this. I mean, we are certainly just natural creatures, but now we have technology that nothing else has had. So I hate this sense that humans are not part of the natural chain of being, but I do recognize that we do produce spaceships and we do pump carbon dioxide into the atmosphere far faster and far more vigorously than any volcano, than all the volcanoes that have ever been on the planet. It's that double-edged sword again. I think we really need to recognize the size of our footprint clunging through here. But secondly, we recognize we are on a dying planet and that either we die with it or we engineer our way through it.
So in the book, you have a little bit of a sneer for the Al Gores of this world and blast for certain kinds of back to pre-industrial life and environmentalists. Are you having a problem with some environmentalism?
Well, I have problems with the sense that people say that let's just take it back to the way it was. And if people are willing to give up the clothes that we have, the transportation, the communication, but most readily, if people are willing to see half of their babies die and die horribly from childhood diseases, if people are willing to see life expectancy go back to 35 years old and willing to see misery during that 35 years, yeah, let's go back to nature. So we're not going to do that. I think I'm a parent. Parents will just not let that happen. So let's be realists. We're not going to go back to nature. We need to contain the problems that we produce. We need to recognize what we're doing, but I think we need to be realists. And I don't think the environmental movement is being realistic about much of what it wants to do.
Well, this is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking with Dr. Peter Ward about his new book, The Medea Hypothesis. I had a little bit of a problem in the book with your portrayal of nature. Naturally, your field of study has been on past mass extinctions, and you find nature can be brutal. But what about all the hundreds of millions of years where life was relatively balanced, like the age of dinosaurs, maybe? Have you forgotten about the good times here on planet Earth?
Well, maybe so. Maybe it's the fact that where I study and what I look at are the crises, and that the crises, when they happen, are such unbelievable wrenches to evolutionary change. Just this last week, we found the most astounding relationship between past oxygen levels and diversity of life. How many genera, really, how many species there are on the planet at any given time during animal life. And it's phenomenal. I mean, it's just an amazing correlation. When oxygen went up through natural causes, the number of species went up. When oxygen goes down, the number of species goes down. It's such a fine thing, controlling the number of species on this planet. Going back to just one or two small variables actually is very powerful. But it also says that you've got a very fine, sort of fine-tuning the way life works on this particular planet. And just a slight change in one aspect, the amount of oxygen, so controls animal life. It gives a sense of how narrow things really are constructed, if constructed is the right word.
Well, now we get to sort of one of the deepest problems, and you've alluded to it. And I'll ask you, as I ask myself, does this sudden knowledge about the horrible past death of life and the coming climate catastrophe, does it temporarily unbalance us sometimes? How do you survive knowing these things?
Well, there's corollaries to that. I've certainly had that thought, and I had some little girl after a talk say, you know, I wouldn't want to be you. You just seem like you're carrying the weight of the world on your shoulders. You poor depressed man. I try to keep a sense of humor about it all, but, I mean, certain things come up. For instance, a colleague and I were talking about paleontology. What a wonderful thing. But can the world really afford to have something as esoteric as we paleontologists, say, in a century from now, if we do have, as I worry, 2 to 3 meters of sea level rise by then, and we're seeing mass starvation? You know, can we have a space program? How much longer can we afford for NASA to be spending so many billions to get to Mars and the moon when we see this climate catastrophe facing us? So it almost looks like triage is coming at us. This might be the last great golden intellectual age where we can dabble in so many things, until I think we're going to have to really concentrate on the problem at hand with much greater vigor than we are now.
So am I correct to say that your science helps you survive personally through knowledge of extreme death events?
Yeah, I think it's just the sense that the natural world has so many laws and that buffet it yet control it in such an interesting way. Intellectually, it's just fascinating to learn more and more about this. And I think in this particular case, I mean, the dinosaurs couldn't see that impact coming. Now, if dinosaurs had invented astronomers, they would have been able to see it. Not that they could have changed things, but maybe. I mean, we can see what we're doing. We have, for the first time, can peer into the future. Nothing else has ever been able to do that, and that has to give us great hope.
Well, as we wrap up, I'm wondering, is there something, I think it's going to take a little time, maybe a decade, for your new idea about the Medea hypothesis to get out to the public. How can we speed that up, and what do you see its role being in the current debates about climate and about life on this planet?
Well, my sense of it is that we inherited this Earth. I mean, we just sort of stumbled into this intelligence through blind, dumb evolution, and that now we understand the rules, I think, far better than any species ever has. It's really in our hands to figure out which way it's going to go. It's going to take great intelligence to get this huge swell of humanity through, I think, the next couple of centuries, which are going to be awful, and try to take us to me, the sense of it is some centuries from now, we can reduce population to several billions instead of 9 to 15 billion, and we can get back to really sustainable development. And I do mean sustainable through enormous increases in technology, where we are having living houses, where we are not running these polluting cars, where we don't have to travel so much. I mean, travel is what's really killing our atmosphere. Travel and the energy needed to make the conveyances that cause the travel. We get back to centralized and use information to do the traveling for us. And so I do see that we can move to really. See, what I think is so funny is that we humans are the only creatures that can really make the world Gaian as Lovelock wanted it to be. I mean, there could be this Gaia, and I think it is our intelligence.
We've been talking with Peter Ward. He's the author of the new book, The Medea Hypothesis, and it's published by Princeton University Press. And I notice on the inside page there, it says that you were selected by a group of scientists at the National Academy to write this book. So I think that puts you well beyond the crank level and somebody with some new things that we all need to know about. Peter Ward, thank you so much for talking with us.
And thank you for great questioning.
All right. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Download this full interview anytime as a free MP3 from our website, ecoshock.org.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Dr. Peter Ward still teaches at the University of Washington while continuing his research trips all over the world. The broad public still hasn't absorbed his groundbreaking explanation of why land animals were killed off in such great numbers in past extinction events. The cause of one mass extinction 65 million years ago was found in an asteroid impact off the Yucatan Peninsula in the Gulf of Mexico. A school of science then insisted such outer space events caused the other four major mass extinctions, including one that killed at least 95% of all living species. But there isn't sufficient evidence for that. So what killed off the species? Peter Ward has found a key possibility. Conditions arose that favored a type of bacteria producing deadly hydrogen sulfide. If the oceans switched to that toxic production, most land animals would be killed off. I've checked with a few other top climate scientists as I've interviewed them, and most agree that Ward is probably on the right track. That one form of living things may have killed off all others, and the enabling trigger was climate change. I won't go into all that right now. Read Ward's book, Under a Green Sky. Ward even tried to reach the public through a TV show on Animal Planet in early 2009 about how the animals went extinct. As you've just heard, Ward's newest work in the book The Medea Hypothesis counters James Lovelock's Gaia Hypothesis. James Lovelock suggested that life offers a negative feedback to counteract dangerous imbalances like climate change. Ward says such corrections are minor compared to the positive feedback by living things that make anti-life swings worse. For example, changes in the Earth's orbit can lead to climate changes, but the reaction of living things to those conditions can make things much worse. In fact, says Ward, life threatens life. The timing of this new book from Princeton University Press has some drawbacks. It tosses geological time into an already confused public, just as we come up to the December climate treaty talks. For example, from the latest science, Ward has assembled our best look at how life will eventually die out on Earth. That's in half a billion to a billion years. It's frightening, but not anything to worry about now. I'm concerned that uneducated people will draw all these fears into life now and into their personal insecurities. That could lead the public to accept more extreme and untested geoengineering solutions, even though the worst problems are millennia or even millions of years away. I'm also hesitant to deconstruct Gaia at this critical juncture. We finally got a portion of humanity into the idea that all life forms are interconnected. We're on the same team. That's very important to saving endangered species and ecosystems. If we teach that nature is a killer bitch, then all our ecological crimes, like mountaintop removal mining, might be justified. We may need the Gaia myth to survive, even if it's only partly true. For the record, I wish Peter Ward had chosen a male to represent the killer urge. When children are murdered, usually the male is responsible in both humans and animals. Why make this evil female again? In our current dive into rapid climate change, Ward thinks human intervention, geoengineering, is the only possible answer. We humans have to become the brains of life systems, he says. That kind of talk drives me crazy. We're already so crazy. It reminds me of the Dick Cheney and the New American Century, a kind of insane coup to replace natural systems with mirrors and gears and chains of command. Who will run the planetary thermostat? Who will try to balance plankton in the oceans? Glenn Beck or the Octomom? Check out our Radio EcoShock special on the risks of geoengineering with scientist Alan Robach. That's a free MP3 download, the September 25th, 2009 program in our archive at ecoshock.org. Folks, we got into this mess by our hubris, and sometimes I doubt we'll escape by the same route. Peter Ward leaves me schizophrenic. I love his science, and I learn from it, and I heavily recommend this new book, The Medea Hypothesis. I mistrust his personal conclusions when it comes to the last chapters. Still, maybe he's right. Maybe we will have to save ourselves somehow instead of trusting to nature, which is willing to let us go into oblivion. You be the judge, Gaia or Medea. Before we come back with the inside scoop on me, Radio EcoShock, let's break for a new climate anthem. It's a rewrite of the famous hit Beds Are Burning by Midnight Oil. updated for the new treaty talks in Copenhagen. The new version is available all over the net. I'll give you an address in just a minute. Be sure and check out the accompanying video. There are dozens of artists, including Duran Duran, Mark Ronson, Jamie Cullum, Fergie, Lily Allen, Bob Geldof, and many others, too many to name. It opens with a quote from Kofi Annan, UN Secretary General, and ends with another by Archbishop Desmond Tutu.
Tick, tick, tick. Climate change is having a real impact on the lives of individuals and communities around the world. We must do something about it. In December in Copenhagen, our leaders will have an opportunity to come up with a robust post-climate agreement that is viable and will help make this planet a better place.
Watch the video at www.timeforclimatejustice.org. It's all part of the tick, tick, tick campaign, the giant clock in the sky counting down our carbonated approach to climate catastrophe. Or not, if by some miracle we can convince our alleged leaders to act in time. Note that the original lead singer of Midnight Oil's Beds Are Burning, Peter Garrett, is now the Environment Minister of Australia. How strange the wheel turns. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Usually I ask the questions around here, Last week, a local college producer, Trevor Van Hemert, rang up to interview me. Many of the questions he asked might be things regular listeners have wondered about, so here goes a 15-minute excursion into our program in our fourth year of broadcasting.
Obviously, I wanted to talk to you about kind of how you see a lot of things developing in the future, including radio, because we're both in the radio industry here. What I'd like to start off with is kind of for our listeners who don't know about your show, kind of an overview maybe of what your show is about and what it is that you're trying to do.
Well, I do two programs in Vancouver. One of them I share with another co-producer, and we go around, we record speeches in Vancouver, usually on social topics, sometimes environmental topics, and then we play them once a week, just a full speech with really nothing to say about them. But my main love and work is the Radio EcoShock show, which is mostly environmental. We do some peak energy and oil issues and occasionally the economy, but pretty well a lot of climate change, I have to say. Started out as a podcast in 2006, went to broadcast on CFRO radio in 2006 as well, and now it's got 15 college and community radio stations plus one commercial station down in San Francisco also broadcasts it. So we've got a fair amount of coverage, and we get podcasts and downloads as well.
So in San Francisco, you're actually syndicated on a commercial station.
That's right. We're on Green 960 AM, 10:30 Sunday nights. You can't get it in Canada. The broadcast is limited to the United States.
For the other stations, the community stations, is that enough for you to make a living off of, syndicating all those shows?
Absolutely not. I don't make a dime out of the program.
Oh, really?
And knew that going into it.
Hmm.
It's a labor of love, and I'm retired for one reason or another, and so that's what I do.
So it's more of a community service to Canada and the U.S. to raise awareness.
Exactly.
So I want to know, because for our listeners who don't know much about this, your personal expectations for the future of the Western world. I know you go a lot into climate change, but to kind of elaborate on that, where society is going there.
Well, I just read a paper by some eminent scientists who conclude that there isn't a structural framework to deal with the global types of crises that we have coming on us, not just climate change, but food production, the spread of diseases, all sorts of factors. And national governments can't or won't handle it, and the international structure is too weak to do anything about it. So they predict that we're just going to go through a series of disasters with little plateaus that don't seem so bad in between.
Yeah, and they say we're in one of those plateaus right now after the oil hit $145.
I would say, and also it seems like all the stimulus money and various other maneuvers and sort of, well, basically hiding the books by banks have covered over the genuine problems in our economy. We don't produce anything here. We can't all be consumers. Consumerism is killing the world anyway. So I'm expecting another serious drop and hit, less so in Canada, but definitely the United States. State revenues are falling tremendously. Governments are going to have to cut way back. It's looking pretty bleak there for the next little while anyway.
And that's another thing I wanted to touch on, is the difference between the U.S. and Canada and where those two are going and exactly why the U.S. is going to be doing so much worse and what to expect as a Canadian.
So much of our exports are to the United States, and our cultural feelings, which do matter, are also tied deeply into the United States media. So I think that Canada will be in for a period of difficult times, but not as difficult because we have so many resources compared to our population. And we'll continue to export some of those to the places that can make it, such as China and other parts of Asia, as well as Europe. So I think we'll muddle through better. And we do have the social safety net, as long as it holds together, that will make life better for the people most hurt by the economic problems.
Now, you mentioned China there, they obviously have a very high population density. So if food is going to become a problem, then how do you think China will fare in all of that?
Food has always been a problem for China. The government doesn't like to talk about it, but there have always been people who are either extremely hungry to starving in China, in the various regions. So I think that's going to continue. However, they do have a cooperative type of system, such as it is, which will distribute food as best it can. So it's very difficult to tell. The northern part of China is drying out dramatically and being impacted by dust from the Gobi Desert, while the southern part is being flooded out. But they're dependent on the Himalayan glaciers. So 20, 30 years out, maybe even 50 years out, those glaciers may not provide summer water for agriculture. So China has a lot of challenges ahead in its future, let's say.
So they'll be importing food from Canada.
Well, maybe. Our crop-growing areas are going to shift towards the north with climate change over a period of decades. I'm not talking about next year. But some of the soils further north are not as good as what we've got now. So our exports may not be as high as what they have been in the past.
So this region in Canada, the Lower Mainland, do you see that as performing a lot better than many other areas in Canada and indeed in the world?
I do. It's what the Ottawa councillor, whose name is escaping me right now, talked about, saying that there will be refugee cities and refuge cities. And in refugee cities, people clear out because the city just can't make sense anymore for various reasons. And a refuge city is where people who can afford to will come to try and get the best of that. And I think Vancouver is going to be one of those. And also our climate will be modified by the ocean currents. So that really helps us out as well. There'll be some flooding along the coast. I wouldn't want to be in some of the new condos that are right down by the ocean in 20 years.
You mentioned in a past show, actually, that you are beginning to stockpile food in preparation for maybe a possible farming disaster, maybe food prices skyrocketing. You had a bean month and a grain month and a rice month. Could you talk a little bit about that and let us know how that project is going?
Yes, I have lived before without electricity, raising a lot of my own food, and so I know how to do those things. When I'm looking at how fragile the food system is here, if the trucks stop rolling for a couple of days, all the supermarkets will be empty. And there are various situations that could cause that to happen, whether it's a pandemic disease or a total economic crash. I mean, that's what happened in Iceland. Their supermarket shelves just emptied out and they weren't replenished. So I see those as sort of bumps. I don't see them as long-term things that people will have to deal with, but there could be 2 months, 3 months of really difficult times for one reason or another, and you should be able to feed yourself for that. It just makes common sense. As long as you have a little bit of money, you can put some grain away in buckets and some beans away in buckets. On the internet, they show you how to do that. It'll last for up to 10 years, even 20 years in the case of grain. And I've got some canned goods and just looked at all the basic things we use. So now when we run out of something in this house, we go to our own storeroom instead of the store for the most part and use those so that we can keep recycling what's in the storeroom. And I also worked this summer on reworking my canning skills, learning how to do canning again, and did some peaches and some rhubarb, just the basics, but made sure that I have the equipment that if we need to harvest food as it comes, we can do so.
And we live in a good place for that. You can have blackberries all year round if you put your mind to it.
Yeah, we even have salmon come up the creek about 2 blocks from our house here.
Really?
There's not a lot of them, but there they are.
And that's is that False Creek?
I'd rather not say which creek it is, but
okay.
It's just
okay.
One of the local creeks here.
You mentioned in that same program that you can cook rice by just soaking it in water.
Yes, it's one of the few foods of that sort that you don't have to cook. It's not very tasty. It's pretty mushy.
Yeah.
But it's very digestible, and you get the food value out of it.
Yeah, I was going to ask if you've actually tried it.
I have, and I didn't like it much, but if I was really hungry, I'd like it a lot.
Yep. Yeah, if you're starving, it'll taste good. I want to move on to where you see the industry of radio going. I mentioned in the beginning of the show that I'd like to talk about that.
the thing is, I'm part of the problem for people who are getting radio training now and want to go into the industry. You will be competing with people who can do it from home with their own home studio and may have another means of support and can do it for free, so to speak. So there are unpaid journalists out there. There are over 300 of them at Co-op Radio here in town who produce their own shows. Some of them have been doing it for years, and it's just for the love of it. So amateurism is one factor in the future of radio. But I think that commercial radio can continue because of its low production values. It's cheap to produce compared to television. So where television stations may go bankrupt and become less meaningful in the face of the internet and newspapers, radio is a more personal medium, and we get to hear other voices and the emotions that go along with that. And it's so cheap to put up your own transmitter even. Look at the low-power FM movement in the United States, that I see radio continuing.
So you think radio is going to grow to kind of take on a larger role in people's lives?
It will, but a lot of people will listen to it over the internet, so it's going to be hard to say whether is that really radio or is that a podcast or what is it. The form of our media is changing dramatically, and I can't even predict what it's going to look like.
Yeah, like you said, you started out as a podcast and then moved into radio.
That's right, and I also ran an online radio station for 2 years on the environment out of my living room. Just had a computer here, and I had a server where they dished it out. But to be honest, we only had 8 to 12 listeners at any one time. Now, that's 24 hours, 365 days a year, so it added up to about 200,000 listens a year. But the actual audience at any one time was too tiny. Now, maybe that's changed, but I doubt it. I think somehow it all has to be integrated into the net to work properly.
Now, you mentioned you only had a few listeners on that radio station you did. Now, how is EcoShock doing, which is the podcast that I came to find you by? Is that a growing podcast that a lot of people are downloading?
It's growing, but slowly. What happens is we have about 430, I think, right now, podcast subscribers, which isn't bad.
430?
Yeah.
Okay.
But we get about 2,000 downloads of the program, including those 430 podcasts, every week or within 2 weeks of the show being broadcast. So there's a bit of a listener audience there. That's probably as big as our audience here in Vancouver. Or on Boston College Radio, for example. And then people keep downloading each show about 200 times a month, going right back to around 2007. So the one thing about the internet is we have to think of radio expanding over time. Your listener audience is not right now as you broadcast necessarily, but it's now and for the next few years.
And my final question here today is, in your view, how will the role of business in general change in our lives?
That's such a huge question. Corporations are in serious trouble, in my opinion, and we will see some of them fail and leave holes that could only be filled by cooperative things like credit unions or food co-ops and that sort of thing. I think we're going to see a rebound of people working together on a non-profit basis to fill in the holes where corporations have failed.
And how do you think the role of advertising is going to change? Do you think we're going to be seeing a lot less of it?
Absolutely. We're already seeing a lot less of it. That's why the Condé Nast magazines are folding up some of their issues and why newspapers are struggling. There's just less advertising. We see some advertising on the net, but I think most of us know how to avoid it. So.
Yeah.
The thing is, if we have less of a consumer society, we have less need to push things with advertising.
Well, for me, that would be a definite improvement over what we have right now.
I agree.
So that concludes it for my interview.
All right. Well, would you like to identify yourself so that I can use that in my audio?
Yes, I'm Trevor Van Hemert with Evolution 107.9, broadcasting from the BCIT Burnaby campus.
Thank you very much. I'm Alex Smith from Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much, Alex.
I feel so exposed. This program is building momentum in the guests we have, but I still need your help to spread it to more stations. If you don't have Radio EcoShock in your area, please contact the nearest nonprofit station and ask for it. Just a few requests can make a big impact, you'd be surprised. Surely we need to get this message out to the widest audience as fast as we can. The climate news keeps pouring in. One good source is H.E. Taylor's list of links called Another Week of Global Warming News. Just Google that and you'll find it. His subtitle is true enough, Sipping from the Internet Fire Hose. That's just what it feels like as hundreds of thousands of scientists, governments, institutions, and NGOs work through this climate puzzle under a tightening deadline. Beware you don't get blasted straight backwards by the force of the new information, not to mention the sad reports of a planetary ecosystem in crisis mode. Lately, I've been knocked over by the latest scientific findings. We'll continue to cover that. But now I feel it's time to get back to the streets, activism, and solutions for you. Next week, I'll be covering a conference called Resilient Cities, Urban Strategies for Transition Times, including a panel from the Post-Carbon Institute. Some big green speakers will be at the conference, people you'll want to hear. The following weekend is October 24th, the day when we all show up for climate action at 350.org. You can get the information of where to collect. I'll be covering the crowds and action from my hometown and collecting audio from all over the world for you on Radio EcoShock. Other programs I'm working on, green activism, what's going on, digging in, the urban survival movement, and the global impacts of dust. And finally, that interview with Richard Heinberg is coming up about his new book, Blackout. And through it all, the nagging feeling of an economy falling apart. We'll wrap up with a ditty from Loudon Wainwright III. Remember his Dead Skunk in the Middle of the Road? Same artist, now recorded live in a New York City park, June 19, 2009. At the end, Wainwright just throws up his hands. There's nowhere else to go. Our website is ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening.
Songs about this fabulous swinging new depression we're having, trying to cash in on that. This song is called Fear Itself. Everybody's feeling uptight. Nobody knows when the hammer's coming down. Might be today, tomorrow, or tonight. Everybody's talking about 1929, 80 long years ago. In the 70s, we waited for some gas on a line. Man, it seems like next to nothing now, you know. Ow! Piece of cake. I bought myself a house over in the valley. Thought I had a money-making machine. Can't sell the place now. I'm in a dark alley and I'm living the American dream. You know that job I always said that I hated? Yesterday they gave me the sack. Loving your work is so damn overrated. I just wish to God I had the job back. Ow! Check out the illegals standing on the corner yelling, watching all the cars go by. Lord, they used to look bored, but now they're looking hungry. You can see the desperation in their eyes. I guess you're glad you got yourself a college education. That ought to come in handy one day. I just read about a guy who robbed a filling station on account of college loans he had to pay back. Payback time. Yeah, it's pretty bad here, but it's really bad there. In Iceland, there's a riot going on. In L.A., they're shutting down the DMV on Friday. Now the weekend feels a little too long. You got depression and recession, inflation and deflation. Love that's messing up my heart, soul, and brains.
friends. I'm sick of stimulation. I need a long vacation. I'll take along a book by Maynard Keynes. John Maynard Keynes. British economist. 1893 to 1946. Ow. Grandma used to tell us how she lived through the Depression and the best way out is always right through. But she was mean and crazy, just a nasty old lady. So stay in bed, that's what I'm gonna do.